It's 9 o'clock. It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Let's start off with our announcements. Once again, the California Wilderness Coalition will be having their Sunol Regional Wilderness Camping Trip. Friday, July 23rd through Sunday, July 25th, the California Wilderness Coalition is heading outside this summer, and we want you to come join us and other wilderness conservation supporters on our summer hikes and outdoor trips throughout Northern California. This July, we're heading to the Sunol Regional Wilderness for a weekend camping and backpacking trip. The Sunol Regional Wilderness, located just southeast of Fremont, California, is significant to the Bay Area for its cultural and geologic history, not to mention the fact they used to make movies out there back in the teens. They'll meet Friday night to set up camp and eat dinner at Sunol's main campsite. On Saturday, they'll pack in 3 miles and then take day hikes to explore the rolling hills and landscape of Sunol. On Sunday, they'll hike back to the cars, and getting there about midday. I don't know what they're doing upstairs, but they're banging on the floor. Anyway, what to bring? You'll need layers of clothing, some of which you will have to take off because it will probably be fairly warm. And when you do that, you'll need sunscreen and a hat. For the evenings, you'll need a tent and a sleeping bag. You'll need lots of water. They say 5 liters. I say you should probably bring more. Or maybe that's just for the backpacking part. Bring more, leave it in your car. But you'll need sturdy hiking boots for the whole thing. There is no drinking water in the park, so bring as much water as you'll think you'll need. Food will be provided for a fee of $20 if you call ahead and reserve it. Otherwise, bring your own food. If you have any special dietary restrictions, let them know when you call in. You can make your reservations and do all that kind of interesting stuff. More details, questions, whatever you have, you'll need to talk to Julia. Her email is jkernitz, jkernitz, at calwild.org. Or you could give her a call at 510-451-1450. That's 510-451-1450 for more details about the trip and to reserve your spot. And, of course, you can probably find all this information and more at www.calwild.org. And the California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, July 10th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. They'll be down at Sunset Beach State Park again. They say summertime is here, and you better believe it. Sunset Beach is a special place to go back and visit. It might be foggy in the morning, and it might be warm in the afternoon, and it might be breezy anytime. We will do a variety of follow-up work, including pulling summer mustard and maybe a little leftover radish. There will be natives blooming yellow and pink sand verbena, along with beach burr and coast sagewort. We hopefully will see some dolphins and maybe some sooty shearwaters, and you might see a blue whale if you look out far enough. There will be the regular flybys of brown pelicans, gulls, cormorants, and terns. Hope to see you there. Meanwhile, I have decided that fewer projects through the summer until vacation's over is probably a good thing, and the school year starts back up in September. Remember, in August, the California State Parks is going to have their yearly volunteer celebration day, and you're all invited, and there will be a notice sent out in August. Here are the directions to Sunset Beach. From Santa Cruz, go east on Highway 1 for about 9 miles from the intersection of Highway 17. When you get there, take the San Andreas Road exit. Go right towards the ocean onto San Andreas Road for just over 5 miles to the turnoff for Sunset Beach State Park. It doesn't look like much, so keep your eyes peeled. Make the right-hand turn, head down the road, get your parking pass at the kiosk, and drive on down to the lower day use area. They'll meet at the south end of the parking lot. Be sure you get a parking slip for your vehicle. Tell them at the kiosk that you're there for habitat restoration. And the California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their volunteer program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the parks and natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. That ain't going to happen this weekend, not unless too much fog gets you too morose. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and your water. If you want more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. You could email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net, or visit their website at www.cruisecnps.org. And turning to news, our whaling protester gets a suspended jail term in Japan. In this story by Yoko Nishikawa, with editing by Jeremy Lawrence of Thomson Reuters World Environmental News. Pat Bethune, a New Zealand activist who boarded a Japanese whaling vessel in an attempt to stop an annual whale hunt, was given a 2-year prison sentence, suspended for 5 years, a Japanese court said Wednesday. Regular attempts by the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, a hardline anti-whaling group, to block the whale hunt have sparked anger in Japan, where the government says whaling is an important cultural tradition. Peter Bethune, captain of the sunken Sea Shepherd's high-tech vessel called the 80 Gill, was indicted in April on 5 criminal counts, including one for carrying a knife when he boarded a vessel in what activists say was an attempt to conduct a citizen's arrest. His criminal responsibility is significant, Tokyo District Court Judge Takashi Tawada said at the court, where about 320 people lined up for the 17 seats available for the public. One of Bethune's lawyers said he was relieved that the sentence was suspended, adding that Bethune and his lawyers had no plans to appeal. Bethune wrote in a notebook at the courtroom he was looking forward to seeing his family and friends, the lawyer said. He has no intention of going back to his anti-whaling activities, as he is now focused on writing a book, he added. Bethune, who looked solemn and calm during the court session, is now in the custody of Japanese immigration officials until he is deported, a process the lawyer said could take several days. Japan, one of only 3 countries that now hunt whales, introduced scientific whaling to skirt the commercial whaling ban under a 1986 moratorium, arguing it had the right to watch the whale's impact on the fishing industry. Australia filed a complaint in Japan against Japan in May at the World Court in The Hague to stop Southern Ocean scientific whaling. Outside the courthouse in Tokyo, several people protested with banners calling Sea Shepherd eco-terrorists. And, but Sea Shepherd said Bethune had made a successful mission that helped save the lives of 528 whales. He will be welcomed home to New Zealand as a national hero for having the courage to do what his government was fearful of doing, defending whales from Japanese poachers. And here's news from Oregon. Oregon's Palomar pipeline is indefinitely delayed thanks to members and volunteers like you. BARC tenaciously fought, by the way, BARC is an organization, fought Palomar's proposal to cut 47 miles across Mount Hood National Forest, and today it's time to celebrate it, a job well done. In a letter filed yesterday afternoon with the Federal Energy Regulating Commission, Palomar LLC, a subsidiary of Northwest Natural and TransCanada, claimed to be continuing to seek additional commercial underpinnings for the project. In other words, they didn't have any money, and suggest it may amend its project in the future. Like, maybe amend it to not doing it. That would be a good deal. While Palomar made this sound benign, evidence shows that the recent failure of the Bradwood Landing LNG terminal, that's liquefied natural gas, and unsurmountable public opposition has left Palomar with too little money and too much risk to continue the way it has been. What's next? Despite Palomar's house of cards crumbling, BARC believes it will likely resurrect its proposal within a year. But here's how we know that Palomar will not succeed and why you, yes, you, should spread the news that Oregonians are one and Palomar is zero. In early May, Bradwood Landing Liquid Natural Gas Terminal was suspended and its development company Northern Star filed for bankruptcy while still owing Palomar, also known as Northwest Terminal, $7 million. In late May, Oregonians shocked Northwest Natural shareholders at their annual meeting with a rally of over 200 people demanding that Northwest Natural divest from Palomar. Last week, BARC and Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club filed a challenge with the Department of State Lands lease to Oregon LNG, reducing the likelihood of Palomar finding an alternate supply of gas. And last but not least, over the last 2 years, BARC ground truthers have been collecting data that proves Palomar Pipeline is legally vulnerable as it is likely to violate multiple laws, including the Endangered Species Act. Palomar may be a flash in the pan, but barkers aren't going anywhere. For the Old Growth Forest, Wild and Scenic Rivers, and the Pacific Crest Trail, Alex P. Brown, Executive Director of BARC, wrote this letter for us. And thank you very much, Alex. If you want more information, go to www.bark-out.org. That's bark-out.org. And scientists are beginning a sweeping project to study California redwoods in this story by Paul Rogers of the San Jose Merck. Two of his colleagues dangled on ropes 100 feet from the gnarled branches of a giant sequoia tree. Steve Sillette could hardly contain his excitement. "This site is just juicy. It's loaded," said Sillette, gazing up into the ancient canopy at Calaveras Big Trees State Park. "There are amazing lichens up there. There are aphids being hunted by ladybugs. I found a sizable dogwood tree growing from a branch 210 feet off the ground. The foggy lost worlds atop the world's biggest trees are about to become into sharper focus." Concerned that rising temperatures across California could threaten the future of the state's coast redwoods and giant sequoias in the next century, Sillette, one of the nation's top redwood scientists, and a team of researchers have embarked on a first-of-its-kind project to measure how global warming is affecting California's iconic trees. Over the next 3 years, the team members funded by Save the Redwoods League in San Francisco are climbing immense redwoods and sequoias at 16 locations in California as part of a $2.5 million project. The study's locations extend from the remote corners of the Jedediah Smith Redwood State Park near the Oregon border to Big Basin, close to us here in Santa Cruz, and to the timeless groves of Sequoia National Park to the east in the central Sierra Nevada. Researchers are fitting individual trees, many of which were growing before Europe's medieval cathedrals were built, with sensors to measure for temperature, humidity, rain, fog, light, wind, and barometric pressure. Their goal is to see how the West's most iconic trees respond to changes in temperature and rainfall, along with a reduction in fog, a trend that is already underway. "These are trees that have inspired people for hundreds of years," said Ruskin Hartley, executive director of Save the Redwoods League. "But what does their future look like? We really don't know." Sillette is a Humboldt State University botanist whose pioneering research climbing redwoods 300 feet tall and higher was featured in the 2007 book The Wild Trees by New York writer Richard Preston. As part of the Redwoods and Climate Change Initiative, he and his colleagues are making 3D computer models of several trees at each site, meticulously measuring their girth every 15 feet, their bark every branch larger than 2 inches in diameter, and even the number of cones. They climb the trees by first shooting an arrow attached to a fishing line over a large, high branch. Then they tie a nylon rope to one end and pull the fishing line back over the branch. Finally, they tie one end of the rope to another tree, then ratchet up using ascenders that are used by mountaineers and ice climbers. Once near the top, they unhitch themselves, secure another rope. Well, I hope they secure the rope to the tree first and then unhitch themselves and attach it so that they can move around the highest branches. I don't think the reporter knew anything about climbing safety, but anyway. "It turns out you really can't adequately measure a tree from the ground," said Sillette. "A Christmas tree maybe, but not a redwood." The researchers plan to return every 3 years to take new measurements of the tree's sizes so they can calculate a rate at which the trees are growing, responding to stress, and processing water and light. Scientists are also measuring tree height with laser beams. They hope the project will continue for 100 years. Redwoods have been around for 120 million years or more. They once lived side by side with dinosaurs, with wide ranges through Canada, Utah, Montana, and Southern California. "There are redwood stumps in the La Brea Tar Pit," said Todd Dawson, lead scientist on the team and director of the Center for Stable Isotope Biochemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. "These trees have seen climate change before, but they haven't seen it in the way they are seeing it now," added Sillette, hiking through the thick brush this month. "In the southern edges of Calaveras Big Trees Park, we just don't know how these trees respond to climate change at all. Other than when it's dry, they don't grow as much." Climate change is already underway. The 10 hottest years since 1880, when modern temperature measurements began, have all occurred since 1998, according to the National Climatic Data Center. Less of California's precipitation is falling as snow, and a study in February by Dawson and other scientists found a 33% reduction in coastal fog over the past 100 years, a critical source of water for redwoods. Recent modeling by researchers at the California Academy of Sciences shows that if carbon dioxide continues to build in the atmosphere at the current rate, and it has increased 30% since the mid-1800s due to the burning of fossil fuels. Temperatures, rainfall, and fog levels in the southern end of the Redwood Range in Monterey and Santa Cruz County will become unsuitable to support redwoods by the year 2100. Today, coast redwoods exist along a narrow 450-mile band from Big Sur to the Oregon border. Similarly, giant sequoia live only in parts of the Sierra Nevada. The ancient trees that survive today, hundreds of which are taller than San Francisco's Coit Tower and the Fairmont Hotel in downtown San Jose, made it through a massive wave of old-growth logging that ran from the 1860s to the 1980s. And beyond, only about 4% of California's old-growth coast redwoods remain. In centuries past, warming or cooling resulted in redwoods shifting their ranges and growing in different places. Today, California has 40 million people, and some potential new sites for the trees have already been developed. What can we do? Well, that's the $64,000 question, said Dawson. Our hope is that we can understand where the boundaries and tipping points are. With better data about how redwoods are reacting, political leaders might encourage programs to preserve land farther north to plant new groves of redwoods. Or they might change logging rules or expand controlled burns into redwood forest to reduce fire risk in a drier climate. As part of this project, Dawson takes thin core samples of the trees and then analyzes the isotopes of carbon and oxygen in the tree rings. Using that data, he can measure wood production, the amount of carbon in trees store and annual growth, and can document monthly climate conditions centuries ago and how trees responded. So far, Save the Redwoods League has raised about $250,000 for the project. It has another $500,000 matching grant from Ken Fisher of Woodside. Fisher, a columnist for Forbes magazine, started in the 1970s as a forestry major in Humboldt State, but switched to economics and today is CEO of Fisher Investments, a privately owned money management firm. When you talk to people about what climate change might mean for these forests, there's lots of speculation, he said. Mostly up to now, people have been making wild guesses. This is really an exciting project because nobody's done it before. And let's hope we get some really good data out of that. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service strikes an uneasy balance between mountain lions and bighorn sheep on the Arizona Refuge. In this story by April Reese, an environment and economics reporter. On southern Arizona's Kofa National Wildlife Refuge, the age-old predator-prey chase has returned to the rugged desert mountains, as each month a few bighorn sheep become sustenance for Kofa's small population of mountain lions. But the reappearance of that historic relationship on the refuge could be bad timing for the mountain lions, which returned in earnest only after being exterminated from the region decades ago. Kofa's bighorn population has plummeted over the last decade from 800 to around 400, and wildlife managers believe mountain lions may be to blame. To try to avoid further population declines, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officials announced last week they will begin killing or translocating mountain lions that repeatedly prey on bighorn sheep. Limited removal of individual mountain lions specifically identified as regularly preying on bighorn sheep, whether lethally or through translocation, could help the bighorn sheep population reach objective levels, a final environmental assessment for the plan states. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed removing individual mountain lions from Kofa National Wildlife Refuge if the animals repeatedly prey on the refuge's desert bighorn sheep. The removal plan, signed by agency officials in December but only released on May 21st, targets offending mountain lions, defined as cats that kill two or more desert bighorn sheep within a six-month period. I mean, these guys got to eat. Yeah, I know. The sheep got to live. So what do? Well, I suppose you could stand back and watch. The removals will most likely occur within wilderness. More than 75% of the refuge's 665,400 acres are designated as wilderness. Kofa, the third largest in the Fish and Wildlife Service's refuge system, is part of the Kofa Mountains complex, consisting of six ranges, forming a contiguous block of bighorn sheep habitat. Until its desert bighorn sheep population began to decline, the Kofa Refuge provided animals to other areas, including historic habitat in New Mexico, Texas, and Colorado. Mitch Ellis, manager of the Kofa Mountains Complex, said that while mountain lions are native to the area and play an important ecological role on the refuge, they need to be kept in check to allow bighorn sheep to rebound to the point they can establish viable populations throughout their range. It's critically important to have some bighorn sheep populations that can support a translocation program, he said. That's what COFA's role has been for the last 40 or 50 years. If we don't have a landscape-level conservation issue here, and we are just managing bighorn sheep on COFA, there probably wouldn't be as urgent a driving force to manage them at this level. And them probably meaning mountain lions. But conservation advocates and some wildlife biologists question whether the Fish and Wildlife Service should favor one native species at the expense of another. There's something implicit in the word refuge, said Craig Miller, a Southwest representative for Defenders of Wildlife, who noted that the COFA Refuge was established via executive order in 1939 for the conservation and development of natural wildlife resources, not just bighorn sheep. Mountain lions are key for the ecosystem, Miller added. They were eradicated from this area, and now they're starting a comeback. This is an old-school anti-predator approach to wildlife management. Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity said there is no doubt that mountain lions have a role in the decline of bighorn sheep, and when Fish and Wildlife Service puts their blinders on, they miss part of the story, he said. Rather than target mountain lions, Robinson said refuge managers should look at all of the potential factors in the sheep's decline. That should include examining policies that allow hunting of bighorn sheep on the refuge, as well as a careful study of the effects that motorized recreation may have on the animals, he added. Roy Kearns, a wildlife biologist who worked on the COFA refuge for 25 years and still lives adjacent to it, said the placement of artificial watering holes for bighorn sheep might be drawing both the mountain lions and the bighorn sheep to the same areas, increasing the likelihood of predation. Kern says the refuge's new policy amounts to a death sentence for the 4 to 6 mountain lions who now roam the refuge. The problem is they're not giving mountain lions a fair chance, he said. We all know the mountain lions are going to prey on bighorn sheep. They're going to kill lions if they kill two bighorn sheep within a 6-month period, and that pretty much ensures they'll all be killed. Because we know that any mountain lion that's up to a bighorn sheep country is going to take that many bighorn sheep, more than likely. In recent years, three radio-collared mountain lions on the refuge killed more than 2 bighorn sheep each within a 6-month period, according to the EA for the removal plan. One cat killed 5 sheep in 3 months, another killed 6 in 5 months, and a third killed 16 in 6 months. I mean, they gotta eat. A fourth mountain lion killed 1 sheep in 2 months before Fish and Wildlife Service biologists lost track of him. Kern says he believes mountain lions, which are notoriously elusive, may have inhabited the refuge on and off for decades, long before the decline in bighorn sheep began. In the late 1970s, for instance, a bighorn sheep head found by hunters was determined to be a kill from a mountain lion. But according to Fish and Wildlife Service, mountain lion predation of bighorn sheep has been on the rise in recent years. As of last October, 9 of the 12 documented mortalities of collared bighorn ewes were attributed to mountain lions, the EA says. In contrast, none of the 17 ewe deaths that occurred between 1993 and 1996 were attributable to mountain lions, according to that document. Ellis said Fish and Wildlife Service ruled out disease and also drought, which has gripped the region for most of the last decade. Even during the driest years, bighorn sheep remained healthy, he said. The only difference seems to be lions re-entering the landscape, he said. In addition to culling mountain lions that repeatedly prey on bighorn sheep, Fish and Wildlife Service also plans to continue monitoring for disease and will conduct forage surveys and examine whether recreation is stressing the animals, Ellis said. Adding to the controversy is the role of the Arizona Game and Fish Department, which has worked with Fish and Wildlife Service for years on bighorn sheep management. The animals are hunted both within and outside of the refuge, and the state agency has publicly supported predator control to benefit the bighorn sheep population. The new Fish and Wildlife Service policy is similar to the state predation management plan for areas adjacent to the refuge. In 2007, the Arizona legislature passed a memorial declaring its support for the Arizona Game and Fish Commission to employ all management tools and measures to ensure the recovery of COFA National Wildlife Refuge desert bighorn sheep populations, including the management of predators, water developments, human intervention, and the potential for disease epizootics. Arizona Game and Fish Department officials could not be reached for comment for this story. The option of lethally removing mountain lions was first suggested in an April 2007 report by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Arizona Game and Fish Department. A proposal floated the same year to allow hunting of mountain lions within the refuge was later withdrawn amid protests from conservation groups and the public. But Ellis said Fish and Wildlife Service did not make the decision to cull mountain lions that prey on bighorn sheep lightly. I think a lot of folks think we're killing mountain lions for no good reason, he said. Trust me, nobody likes doing this. Let's turn to some biological diversity news here. Historic Clean Water Act suit seeks $19 billion from BP. Ever hear of them? In the largest citizen enforcement action ever undertaken under the Clean Water Act, the Center for Biological Diversity has filed suit against British Petroleum and Transocean for illegally spewing more than 100 million gallons of oil and other toxic pollutants into the Gulf of Mexico. The suit seeks to ensure that BP pays the maximum possible penalty under the law for causing the largest oil spill in our nation's history, with fines up to $4,300 per barrel of oil if the spill is found to have been the result of gross negligence or willful misconduct, which could be about $19 billion if the spill continues until August, and in all likelihood will. The penalties would be paid to the U.S. Treasury and available for Gulf restoration efforts. We filed this suit to ensure that BP is held accountable for every drop of oil and pollution is released into the Gulf of Mexico, said Kieran Suckling, the center's executive director. We can't bring back dead sea turtles, pelicans, dolphins, or whales, but we can make sure BP is penalized to the full extent of the law for causing the worst environmental disaster in American history. Our lawsuit also seeks to compel BP to disclose the amount of oil now gushing into the Gulf each day, as well as the identity and the amount of all toxic pollutants mixed with the oil. Hazardous chemicals like benzene, arsenic, and naphthalene are also likely being spewed into the Gulf along with millions of barrels of oil. The center's legal team for this lawsuit is comprised of center senior attorney Mark Fink, experienced Clean Water Act litigator Charlie Tibbett, and Damon Kieran of Metairie, Louisiana. And drilling ban canceled, center vows a challenge, siding with big oil in an anti-company lawsuit. A judge has moved to permanently lift the federal government's six-month moratorium on deepwater drilling, and the same day the center filed suit to challenge that decision. The judge's ruling ignores the government's call. After it was compelled by center investigations, numerous media sources, and a public outcry to enact the moratorium in the light of the United States' largest ever spill in the Gulf for more safety measures and further analysis, none of which have been completed to prevent more oil spill catastrophes like the one in the Gulf. The judge's disappointing ruling also lets the Mineral Management Service off the hook for failing to uphold worker and environmental safety when approving offshore drilling projects. The center had intervened in the oil industry lawsuit to cancel the moratorium, so now we're headed back to court to make sure this cancellation doesn't stand. The judge's decision to lift the moratorium makes trades oil industry profits for the safety of offshore workers, the long-term health of the Gulf Coast economy, and the environment, said Center Oceans Program Director Miyoko Sakashida. The ongoing BP catastrophe in the Gulf should be enough to justify putting an end to all offshore drilling. What moratorium? BP launches a massive new drilling project in the Arctic. Just when it seems like BP and the Department of Interior can't sink much lower, comes news that BP is poised to begin a massive, risky, never-before-tried drilling project in the waters off Alaska. The New York Times broke the story in a major front-page expose on the energy giant's plans to drill this fall in the Arctic's fragile waters. There was supposed to be a moratorium on new offshore drilling projects, but BP found a way around that. It heaped together a 31-acre pile of gravel in the Beaufort Sea, called it an island base for a drilling rig, and declared it would be conducting onshore drilling. The project called Liberty would include a dicey technique of drilling 2 miles beneath the sea and then up to 8 miles horizontally, all under enormous pressures in a pristine area that would be devastated by an oil spill. The project already has its state and federal permits, but BP still has to apply for its final permit to drill, which is expected later this year. It makes no sense, said Rebecca Noblin, the center's Alaska director. BP pushes the envelope in the Gulf and ends up causing a moratorium and a disaster, and now in the Arctic they are forging ahead again with untested technology, and as a result they are the only ones left being allowed to drill there. Meanwhile, the Obama administration is considering opening vast new areas of the Arctic, the Atlantic, and the Gulf of Mexico to offshore oil exploration. And we thank the Center for Biological Diversity for these stories. You can find for more information about them at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And that's it for tonight's updates. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Earth First Update is a production of the Earth First Radio and is produced in the studio of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to a podcast or download a previous edition of the Earth First Updates, we want to direct you to the following webpage, www.h2opodcast.com. That's www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And when you want to thank the folks there at h2opodcast.com for archiving Earth First Radio shows. And don't worry, when you go there, the last few Earth First updates are still on my computer, and when I get them all done, we will upload them to h2opodcast.com when those folks get back from their vacation in August. All right. Thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. Tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock.